Job chapter 6, as you make your way there, we focused on the speech of Eliphaz last time that we were here. And so you all know the situation. Hopefully I'll bring it up to speed. If not, but, you know, Satan came and approached God and was looking to, you know, do his thing, mess up lives and stuff. And God says, "Hey, Satan, have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan, of course, was going, "Oh, man, you know what? That guy's not going to budge. You're blessing him too much. You're doing too many good things to him. That guy's not going to be swayed by anything I can do." And Satan's kind of like, you know, "Let me at him, and then we'll see this guy curse you and really see what he's all about." And so God lets Satan come and just kind of ransack his life and turn it upside down to the point of having children taken from him, lives just devastated, and to his own detriment, his own great illness coming upon him, where now Job is a man who's sitting in great pain. He's suffering. He's just going through a lot of difficulty right now. And yet through it all, he is continuing to not turn on God. He's not rejecting God. Though he's asking questions, he's not turning on God. Just like we sing in that song, "Yet I will still praise him." You know, we sang it tonight, right? No matter what we go through, you're still with us, God. And still I'll praise you. And this is Job's attitude and song, but it's been difficult. And so he's got three friends that come to him now. And so we're starting to see this section in Job where one of his friends will speak and then Job will respond. And then another friend will speak and then Job will respond. Another friend will speak and Job will respond. And these three friends are coming to Job and they're basically saying, "Job, just, you know what? Just get right with God, all right? There's obviously sin in your life, because God wouldn't be punishing you this way if you were an upright man. So you just need to repent, Job." That's kind of what these guys are saying. And so we saw that happening with Eliphaz in our last study. Eliphaz shares through chapter 4 and 5 of Job. And now in chapter 6, we see Job beginning to answer his friend Eliphaz that has been laying into him here now. Now, these three friends of Job came to be with him and mourn with him through all of Job's distress. But now, rather than just sitting and being a support to Job, they began to seek answers and solutions to God's to Job's problems. That's what they're doing. It's clear there must be sin, there must be error. And so they're trying to find solutions, finding answers for the something that Job can do to alleviate all this. But the primary lesson for us in the book of Job is the sovereignty of God, that he does what he wills. What Job is experiencing is not a direct correlation to sin or judgment. It's so that God may carry out his purposes through the life of Job. You see, our lives exist for the glory of God. That's why we are here. Our lives exist for the glory of God, to make it known. If we had the opportunity then of bringing glory to God and making him known in a special way through life's challenges and controversies, then we need to be ready to accept that and be okay with that, to say, "God, if you're carrying out your purposes in this situation, even in the midst of this tragedy, then God, I need to say, that's what I exist for. And so God, have at it. Just be glorified, be magnified in and through my life." And so the story of Job teaches us that God won't always give us the answers that we're looking for, but he will uphold us and he will sustain us and cause the end to be that much more greater than anything else that we might have endured for him presently in this life. So again, chapter 6 and 7, Job is responding to the things Eliphaz said to him. And then in chapter 8, we're going to see friend number 2 chime in, Bildad. And his words aren't going to be any more encouraging than Eliphaz's were. So look at chapter 6, verse 1. "Then Job answered and said, 'Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it on the scales, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me.'" So here's Job, and he's just kind of really being honest. He's expressing the anguish of grief that he's been going through, the greatness of this grief and that he had every right to grieve. You could take all the calamities that he's been experiencing and you could put them on a scale and then take all the sand, you know, of the shores of the sea and take all that sand and put it on the other side of that scale and the calamities are going to be tipping in favor of and in greater measure than all the sand, because this is how much Job has just been weighed down by these things. They've been difficult. They've been hard. And so he's saying, my words, yeah, they have been rash. They've been strong because I've just been so down and discouraged by all this. It's been difficult for me. Have you ever been through a time where you could say that all of my tragedy, all of my difficulty is outweighing all the sand on the shores of the sea? Can any of us say that? One thing I like to say is this, why serving the body of Christ is such an important thing to do, because it gets our focus off of, you know, our own troubles and trials. When we begin to serve one another, we begin to focus on things that aren't about us. And we begin to focus on other people, and we sometimes begin to see, oh man, this person's really going through a hard thing. This person's really going through a difficulty. And it begins to make our, you know, difficulties just a light affliction. Something where we go, man, in comparison, I really don't have a lot to complain about. And I hope, you know, when we go through the book of Job, that it's causing us all the more to say, man, I really don't have a lot to complain about. Thank you, Lord, that you haven't, you know, made me like Job. Thank you that you haven't put me in Job's shoes. And don't get any ideas, God. I'm just saying that as an example. Don't get any ideas here. I'm not asking for that. Not looking for that. But thank you. And that's why, you know, when we come alongside and we serve one another, sometimes people say, oh man, I'm just really going through a hard time and I just can't. Sometimes that's when we need to get up and just start to serve others and be a blessing to other people, because it starts to cause our own problems and difficulties to feel a little bit lighter and not to seem like, oh man, nobody knows, nobody understands. I'm going through such a dark period right now. And then when we start to step out and we go, oh man, there's other people that are grieving, other people that are going through hardships. And wow, that's really, you know, makes my problems seem that much less important or significant. So we see that we really don't have it that bad when we look to Job, and that's why it's good to do so. Now, Job has been speaking harshly. He's been impulsively speaking, and we got to cut him some slack, because this guy's really been going through the fire. I mean, this guy has had it bad. He even compares the difficulty to being shot with poisonous arrows by God there. And his spirit now has just been bitter within him. What he has needed from his friends has been encouragement. They, however, have just fed more of that bitterness to him. So Job is expressing his right to them and his need to mourn and grieve through this time. And that's an important thing. We don't, as Christians, need to put on a fake facade, a brave face, and just go, well, I just got to, you know, put on a stiff upper lip and just power through. I mean, we can grieve, we can mourn, we can be honest about these things. And Job is being very honest about these things. And he says in verse 5, does the wild donkey bray when it has grass, or does the ox low over its fodder? Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are as loathsome food to me. So he says here, does the donkey or the ox keep howling when it has been fed? No, it doesn't. You feed it and it's content. And Job says this to tell his friends that they should be feeding him words of encouragement. They should be helping him. They should be coming alongside to where there's sympathy and support, not more guilt being added onto Job's plate. So he says, man, there's no wonder I've been speaking so strongly, because you guys have not been a help to me in any of this here. You've been kind of adding this bitterness. And again, how careful we need to be when we come alongside people in pain. We don't need to figure things out for them and find the answers or solutions. We just need to come alongside and be a source of comfort to them. May your time with them lead them full and satisfied, rather than feeling like they've been sucking on an egg. And that's kind of what Job is saying here. Do egg whites have any flavor or taste to them? No, that's what it's been like with you. You just added nothing to this situation here. And I pray that we may come alongside people and and be a help and encouragement to them where they're like, man, that is just, that's built me up. That's caused me to be full and satisfied rather than sucking on an egg. So verse 8, oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have comfort, though in anguish I would exult. He will not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me, and is success driven from me? So here's Job again. He's been really honest. And his desire was just to have God come and take him out. God, just crush me already. Just remove me. I would be more happier just kind of being removed from this earth and from existence than having to go through this. He wanted God just to answer that one request. You ever had times where you've wondered why God hasn't answered your request? God, why aren't you moving in the way I want you to move? Why aren't you acting in the way that I'm feeling like that would be the right answer here in this situation? That would be the most help, Lord. Why aren't you acting? I'm praying. I'm calling out to you, God. Why aren't you moving in this way? Have you ever been in those situations? Sometimes the answer is simply no to your request. We go, you're not answering me because you're not answering in the affirmative, in the yes. We think if there's not a yes, if he's not going to do what he's saying, then he doesn't answer my prayer. But sometimes the right answer to our prayer is no. And that's as much of an answer as yes is. Because we don't have all the knowledge of the Father. Though we think we might have the right solution, an easy way out, God's conducting business on a higher level than we are privy to. And so our solution may not be compatible with God's plans and purposes. And he says, I'm going to withhold your request because you don't really know what you're asking for. You need to trust me. You need to wait and see what I'm going to accomplish through this. Yes, yes, we pray. Yes, we take things to the Lord. Yes, we seek him. And yes, there's nothing wrong with making requests, but we need to trust that we're in that time of prayer, getting the Father's heart on these matters. And that we're not looking to change God's will to match ours, but that our will is becoming matched to the Father's will. And our heart becoming matched to the Father's will. That's what prayer does. That's what we do when we come to him and just spend time with him. But we're certainly not the ones that are able to come and give the Lord advice or give him solutions to our problems. Say, God, how come you're not doing this? I've drawn it all out. It looks pretty good to me. Remember what we read in Romans 11, verse 34 on Sunday? For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor? Can any of us come alongside and start giving counsel to the Lord? To where the Lord's going to be like, oh, that's a really good point there. Didn't see that one. Didn't think that through. All right. How am I supposed to do that now, Brent? Okay, let me lay that out here. Okay, sure. I'll get right on that. Who's to bring counsel to the Lord? So we need to trust the Lord and understand that our requests may not be granted, but you can believe God has your best interest at heart. So Job could take comfort in the fact that through his anguish, he's not denied or disobeyed the words of the Holy One in verse 10, he says there. Then I would still have comfort, though in anguish I would exult. He will not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. He has kept his integrity, in other words. And Job reveals the condition he's in and the reason he's been longing for death. He has no more strength. He feels just completely helpless. That's what he's saying at the end there, verse 11 and 12. What strength do I have that I should hope? Is my strength the strength of stones? It's just nothing. I'm just like dead weight here. Or is my flesh bronze? It's not, he's saying. I have nothing in and of myself now. I'm feeling helpless. I'm feeling hopeless. And without any chance of success. That's kind of what Job is saying. That's why he's reasoning and speaking this way and longing for death. Well, Job continues on just to contend with his comforters now here in verse 14. And he says, to him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. My brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the streams of the brooks that pass away, which are dark because of the ice and into which the snow vanishes. When it is warm, they cease to flow. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their way turn aside. They go nowhere and perish. So Job lets his friends know that, they should be coming alongside him, and they should be speaking kind words to him. They should be coming alongside, lending support and sympathy during this trial. Even when the person that is suffering has not been right with God, like they say, like Job says in verse 14, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Even if a person is guilty, that's not your time to come and beat up on him when he's going through suffering. Yes, you can point him to the Lord, but it's not the time to lay guilt and more suffering on him. We shouldn't be coming down on people, but being kind to them, looking to build them up and again, point them to the Lord. Job's friends were more interested in just kind of having this theological debate with him than they were in actually comforting Job. Man, Job's a mess right now. He's hurting. He's in agony. He's in pain. Not only physically, but internally. Think about the loss to loved ones he's had. This man is hurting. And now these guys are coming alongside. They're looking to have a theological debate with Job and figure out why God's doing this. This must be the reason why, Job, you got to repent. You got to get right. There's no comfort in that. Especially when there was no repenting for Job to do. That's the problem. And they had been somewhat deceitful. He says in verse 15, my brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook. They've been somewhat deceitful. They've come alongside Job. They sat with him for those 7 days, just being in silence. But then they kind of, you know, disappeared when Job needed them the most. They kind of turned on him. They were like streams that would be there one day and then disappear the next. That just sitting in comfort and support vanished. Verse 19, the caravans of Tema look, the travelers of Sheba hope for them. They're disappointed because they were confident. They come there and are confused, for now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. Did I ever say, bring something to me or offer a bribe for me from your wealth or deliver me from the enemy's hand or redeem me from the hand of oppressors? Now, we get a little bit of insight here in that passage I just read into Job's friends and their perspective on what is going on. Because it says there in verse 21 that they're afraid, right? For now you are nothing, you see terror and are afraid. They're afraid. You see, their whole premise of God is that he's a just God and he will punish evil and disobedience and sin. And he'll bless a person for obedience and faithfulness. So they're desperately trying to figure out what sin Job has been involved in. If he hasn't been involved in sin, then this upsets the whole apple cart. The whole basis of for their own well-being is faulty. They're thinking, we're doing good, we're healthy, we're strong, because we're walking upright, because we're innocent, we're righteous, there's no sin in our lives. This is their whole theological premise here. That God is going to reward those who are walking in purity and sinlessness, but those that are walking in sin, he's going to punish quickly. And so now if Job is going through all this simply because it's the hand of the Lord and not anything to do with what Job has done, then suddenly they're going, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Because the same thing might happen to us then. We're basing our success and our health upon our good living. And if it has nothing to do with that, then we could be next in line. And so they look at Job, it says in verse 21. They see, and now there's just terror. They're afraid. And so they're desperately going, Job, there's got to be something. Come on, Job, please help us out here. There's got to be some error in your life. That's why you're going through this. How can God do that to somebody that's innocent? This totally upsets the whole apple cart for them of their theology. And this was freaking them out. But I pray that this lesson of Job, and through this lesson of Job, I pray that we increasingly realize that God is God, that he is sovereign. And that he does what he does to carry out his purposes. And we aren't always aware or can understand how he can pull out a positive through our suffering. But we have to trust that even in our suffering, God may allow that to carry out his purposes. And that it may not have anything to do with judgment or punishment, but simply for God's purposes to be carried out. This is what the story of Job is sharing to us. And we have to trust God in that. Remember the centurion that was at the cross of Jesus. When Jesus is at the place of greatest suffering, he's on the cross and he's dying. And Jesus gives up his last breath. And the centurion looked at him and said, "Truly this was a righteous man. Surely this was the Son of God." It was in seeing how Jesus handled pain and suffering that caused that centurion to look to God. Oftentimes the Lord's methods in leading people to God is to put a believer on a platform and reveal how they handle suffering. That's what God is doing with Job. We often want to avoid these times of difficulty, don't we? We want to run from those situations. We don't welcome them, and that's a fair assessment, I think, for most of us. You'd be a little bit off if you did. But we don't welcome these things, but we have to understand that sometimes that platform of suffering are the very things God uses to convince unbelievers of the faithfulness and the goodness of God when he brings people through the trials of life and the fiery furnaces of this world. When he allows people to go through hardship and the fires, and when God is faithful to lead them through and cause them to endure, that causes people to go, "How'd you do that? How are you still standing? How are you still standing without just cursing God, blaming God, or just being angry and upset?" That's the Lord. And we get to share with people the Lord's faithfulness and goodness and strength and peace in the midst of our suffering. Something that the world is sadly lacking. And we get to show them a different way. And we get to point people to Jesus. Don't freak out, but understand that God is using you to let people see how he upholds and delivers his people through those times. And he'll do that with Job. And Job gets recorded down in history for many people to see as an example of the goodness and the faithfulness of God, even through trial and suffering and hardship. And your life can be that same example to another person. And sometimes the Lord will allow a difficulty in your life. And it's not always because of sin or punishment. It's so that God can be God and say, I'm gonna magnify my name through you and through this situation in your life. Will you let him do that? Because it'll be a great blessing for you in it too. So Job asked his friends, if he's ever asked them to do anything for him there in verses 22 and 23, did have I ever asked anything of you or asked you to offer a bribe for me or deliver me from the enemy's hand? Have I ever been a place of just asking anything? And yet all he's asking for from his friends is just a little bit of sympathy, a little bit of a caring heart, a little bit of compassion, a little bit of mercy. Job's like, man, I've already had it pretty bad. I don't need you guys adding to that here. He says in verse 24, "Teach me and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I've erred. How forceful are right words. But what does your arguing prove? Do you intend to rebuke my words and the speeches of a desperate one which are as wind?" Verse 27, "Yes, you overwhelm the fatherless and you undermine your friend. Now therefore, be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede my righteousness still stands. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory?" Job asked them to just reveal where he has messed up. Go ahead, lay it out there for me. Let me know, where have I been wrong? What sin have I committed? He asked him, if you can just be clear on this, then he says, I'll hold my tongue. I won't keep speaking. If you can just lay it out for me what I've done and convince me on that, then I'll hold my tongue. If there's truth in it, then it'll be clear and strong. He says, how forceful are right words, honest words. They're strong, and I will receive that. Job speaks very strongly to his friends here, wondering if they're going to continue to rebuke his words, because Job himself has spoken very honestly with them. And he says to them, my righteousness is still intact. Yes, concede. My righteousness still stands, verse 29, he says. He asks if he has lied or deceived them in any way. The expected answer is, of course, no. Job has maintained his integrity. And he goes on to say in chapter 7 here, verse 1, is there not a time of hard service for man on earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hired man, like a servant who earnestly desires the shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages? Verse 3, so I have been allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be ended? For I've had my fill of tossing till dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. Job reflects on kind of the general futility of man's life. And he uses a few illustrations here. First of all, that of a military man who's enlisted kind of into an army. He's doing service now, basically. Is there not a time of hard service for man on earth, he says in verse 1. He also talks about the laborer, a hired man, and then a servant. Now, at least with the soldier, it's an appointed time that he serves. And he knows that there's coming an end to that. And with the laborer and servant, there is the wages that the laborer receives. For the servant, he gets to kind of rest at night, you know, find the shade of the day and just lay down and rest. He's put in a full day, now he gets to rest. But with Job, he's saying, I don't get any rest from this. I don't know what the appointed time is. I'm not getting any wages from this right now. Again, Job didn't know what God had in store. Job wasn't aware of any of the stuff that God was doing behind the scenes. But at the moment, he's going, I have no comfort in any of this. Nothing to look forward to is what he's saying. It had been months of futility. Notice that there in verse 3. Months of futility. We don't know how long Job had to go through this ordeal. We're not exactly sure, but we do know it was longer than days and weeks. This is extending over months now. Some believe it was maybe a 6-month period of time. We're not sure on that, but we read here, months of futility he was going through. He couldn't get any rest at night, right? He would lie down and say, when shall I arise and the night be ended? He couldn't get a good night's rest. He was just in pain and discomfort. Difficult. His body was all pussy and scabby and worms were just, you know, crawling around on it. Just bleh, gross, right? Not a pleasant picture here. That's what Job is going through. He says in verse 6, My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As the cloud disappears and vanishes away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him anymore. Now, Job isn't implying that his life is moving quickly from day to day, because he just finished saying that that wasn't the case. It's like just, it's just futility. There's like no end in sight. What he is saying, rather, he means that his life is near its end. And the weaver's shuttle moves rapidly across a loom in the making of cloth. It's quick. And he's saying, this is just kind of, you know, been rapidly sort of moving along here in his life without any hope. There's been no hope for him here. There's been no expectation of any kind of recovery or relief for Job. And Job addresses the Lord and asks him to remember that his life is but a breath. It's just a breath. He's just a mere mortal. And he's a frail one at that right now. So Job said, I don't see any good coming of this. I don't see any end in sight. And he's resolved to just dying and moving to the grave, never to be seen again. This is kind of Job's request here. This is what Job's asking God to do in a sense. My life is just a breath. Just extinguish it already, you know. And he says here in verse 11, therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. I mean, that does not sound like a hopeful guy here, does it? Just tell us how you really feel, Job. Lay it out there. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's laying it out there for us. He's not pulling any punches. He's just sitting here going, why am I even here? There's no comfort. There's no peace. There's no future kind of outlook here. This is just not going to end well. He's asking God, am I a threat? Am I like the sea or a sea serpent, he says in verse 12? Is there any reason, God, that you need to focus on me? Am I any kind of threat to anyone or to you? Haven't I been living a good life? I mean, living it for you? Why are you putting such a heavy on me? Why are you focusing on me? There was no reprieve for Job. When he thought he could even lie down and get some rest, he says, you awoke me, God, with nightmares. You just weren't leaving me alone. He would rather himself just be strangled than have to endure through all of that. And so Job is asking if God could just leave him alone for the very few remaining days he has left. Just let me alone, for my days are but a breath. And he's going, Job's resolved to go, I'm not going to have much longer here. So God, could you just do me a favor? Just go focus on somebody else right now and just let me die already. It's kind of what Job is saying. Now again, we saw last time, even though Job asked to be just, you know, removed, taken away, he never contemplated suicide. He never looked at ending his life. He gave it to the Lord and said, God, would you just do something here? Suicide's never an option, never a way out for us, because we never know what God is going to do. We're never without hope with God. And Job's a great illustration of that. Yeah, we have to get to near the end of the book to see that, but we're going to see that God had nothing but good in mind for Job. And Job says in verse 17, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be. So Job asks these questions of God from just a bad place in life. He's basically asking, why are you so interested in me to keep watch over me and keep me pressed down? Job felt he couldn't even swallow his own saliva without the Lord interfering and kind of feeling like he was getting choked through it. It's like, God, you just can't even let me alone to just, you know, swallow. I just feel like I'm constantly under pressure. But we have to recognize what an amazing thing it is that God has indeed set his heart on us. Think about that. I mean, Job's speaking from a bad place, but he's speaking something pretty interesting here in verse 17, that you should set your heart on man. What is man that you should exalt him? How has God done that? By making man in his image, and then redeeming us after we fell. God has set his heart on us. He has shown his love for us by sending his son to die for us when we least deserved it. Job basically wanted God to ignore him and leave him alone. But God had a heart for Job, even in the midst of suffering. If you've ever doubted whether the Lord loves you or is for you, then just keep your focus on the cross. Just be reminded of the extent that God went to redeem you and to bring you in a right relationship with him. That says it all for us. The cross says it all for us. God has set his heart on us. It's amazing. And so Job ends here, this chapter, by asking God to reveal what he's done. If indeed he has sinned, if I have wronged you, forgive me and take away my iniquity. This is Job now, you know, asking God, like, Lord, I don't know what I've done. Show me and I will repent. If there's sin, forgive me, God. Job isn't getting upset with God, but he's looking to be right with God. And then in chapter 8, we see Bildad step onto the scene now. Friend number 2 comes on and he begins to lay out kind of the same argument that Eliphaz was laying out. We'll see that here. Verse 1, then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you speak these things? And the words of your mouth be like a strong wind. Does God subvert judgment? Or does the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression. If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. Though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly. Bildad comes on the scene and basically tells Job he's just blowing a lot of hot air. How can you talk like this? The words in your mouth be like a strong wind. You're just blowing a lot of hot air. It reminds me of a pastor friend of mine who put a hot air hand dryer in the bathroom at his church, but removed it only 2 weeks later. Somebody asked him why, and he confessed that they worked fine, but when he went in there, he saw a sign that read, for sample of this week's sermon, push the button. So Bildad sees Job as just kind of blowing a lot of hot air, you know, not making much sense. And Bildad, here he had the nerve to say that your sons basically perished because they sinned against God. God took them out because there was sin in their lives. So they kind of got their due. Bildad, like all of Job's friends, saw God as judging sin harshly and punishing sin quickly, but then blessing obedience and faithfulness. This is how they viewed God. God's going to punish sin, but he'll bless those that are walking in faithfulness. And his counsel to Job is that if you're pure and upright, well then, Job, you'd be prospering right now with God. Remember, these friends of Job were the originators of the health and wealth gospel. They were the name it and claim it crew here. And they believed that, man, you just, you know, you honor God and you're going to be wealthy and healthy and you're going to prosper. They go on to say, Bildad goes on to say in verse 8, for inquire, please, of the former age and consider the things discovered by their fathers. For we were born yesterday and know nothing because our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words from their heart? So Bildad wants Job to inquire of his fathers here. Seek the wise old men of yesteryear. You go and find out what they would have to say or what they recorded, what they wrote down. And you will find, even though he says we're young in comparison to them and we don't have the same experience as they have, you will find that what they would say lines up exactly what we say. This has been the thought all through history is kind of what they're saying to Job. Don't question what we're saying. This has been said from long ago. This has been the common understanding with many that God punishes the wicked and he blesses the righteous. Now, there's definitely truth to that, but they weren't seeing this all in the right light in the case of Job's life. And so Bildad, he gives some examples from nature to kind of back what he's saying here. He says in verse 11, can the papyrus grow up without a marsh? Can the reeds flourish without water while it is yet green and not cut down? It withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the hypocrite shall perish. Whose confidence shall be cut off and whose trust is a spider's web. Verse 15. He leans on his house, but it does not stand. He holds it fast, but it does not endure. He grows green in the sun and his branches spread out in his garden. His roots wrap around the rock heap and look for a place in the stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I have not seen you. So he talks about the papyrus, and the papyrus needs the water of a marsh to grow. The reeds need water to grow. Otherwise, they're going to wither and die and be removed. Bildad's point is that this is what happens to those who forget God, who neglect God. They're going to wither and die. They're going to be plucked away and removed. Bildad says those who live this way have as much stability as a spider's web. You know, you can just walk through a spider's web and knock it down. Don't you hate? That's like one of my greatest, walking through a spider web, it just goes right on you. And then the spider, sometimes they're crying. You're like, ah! And all day you're going, I think there's a spider on me. Isn't that the worst? But they're unstable. You know, you don't bounce off the spider's web and be like, wow, that's a strong spider's web. It's unstable. And so this is what Bildad is saying. Those that live that way, who are forgetting God, they're just no more stable than a spider's web. He's got nothing that's going to stabilize him. Goes on to say, verse 19, behold, this is the joy of his way. And out of the earth, others will grow. Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked will come to nothing. Bildad ends his speech here now by repeating his whole theological premise that God will not tolerate the evildoers, but he'll be near to the blameless. And again, like I said, there's truth in that. But it's not in the way that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar saw it. It's a general truth, but what Job is experiencing is not based on those truths. It's like saying that all wives love receiving flowers from their husbands. Yesterday being Valentine's Day, I bet a lot of you men were running out, maybe. Not ask for a show of hands, because I'll put you on the spot, but it's a general truth. All wives, you know, they would love flowers from their husbands. But my wife would say to me, why'd you spend money on flowers? Go and mop the kitchen. Clean the kitchen. As much BS. Much better than flowers. I'll take that any day. Sadly, for me, it's much easier to buy flowers. It's like, but I want to buy flowers. It's easier. I don't need to bring out the mop and bucket. Sometimes the easy answer is not what God is working out. We have to be careful that we don't say, this is what God must be doing in this situation. This is why you're experiencing this. This is the general truth. And so now this must be what's happening, and seeking the easy answer, the easy way out. It's a general truth. Yes, we understand that God isn't going to tolerate sin. That there's coming a day when the wicked will perish. Yes, we get that. And the righteous, who are righteous only because of Jesus, yes, are going to be sustained and spared and saved. Yes, we get that. But this wasn't the situation for Job. There's no explanation for Job's situation other than the sovereign hand of God at work in his life, doing that which God willed for him, for his glory, not Job's. And these people all needed to simply trust that. They need to trust and go, Job, we don't understand this. We don't know why you're going through this. But we don't need to look for the easy answer or try to find fault in you. We need to say, God, what do you want to do through this? And that's a good lesson for all of us. When we're going through something, instead of saying, God, get me out of this, we need to say, God, what do you want me to get out of this? What do you want to teach me? What do you want me to learn through this? Our quick prayer, our easy answer is, Lord, get me out of this. But sometimes the Lord brings us through difficulties to grow us and to teach us. And our prayer should be more so, Lord, what do you want me to get out of this? What do you want to share with me, teach me, and have me learn in this time? Much of what they're saying is true. Bildad said earlier in verse 7 that, you know, the latter end would increase abundantly. He's like, Job, get right with God and God's going to bless you. Yeah, there's truth to that. And we see that in the story of Job. He says here in verse 22, in verse 21, he will yet fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. He's like, man, God's going to bless you. God wants to reward. Yes, there's truth in that. But again, their theological premise was just a little bit off in how they were applying these things to Job. Now, chapter 9, how are we doing for time? We're going to run through chapter 9. It's an interesting chapter, and I'm just trying to see here what kind of time we've got here. Okay, You guys doing all right? Chapter 9? Rattle it off real quick? Okay. Let me just say this here. Job's rambling response to Bildad in chapter 9 here is kind of difficult to divide into paragraphs. The patriarch is giving vent to emotion, which does not express itself in cold logic. At times in this speech, Job takes up, again, matters discussed earlier by Eliphaz. A twofold analysis of the speech seems best. Job speaks of, one, the might of God, which prohibits man from making a credible defense of his innocence, and two, the mind of God, which alone holds the key to the mystery of suffering. So here's Job's response to Bildad, and really just, he just kind of rambles on, and a lot of people have it's a difficult chapter to kind of decipher and kind of move through, and we'll do our best just to, you know, make some sense of that here. But we read in chapter 9, verse 1, that Job answered and said, "Truly I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered? He removes the mountains, and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun, and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. If he goes by me, I do not see him. If he moves past, I do not perceive him. If he takes away, who can hinder him? Who can say to him, 'What are you doing?' God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him." So Job is saying that what Bildad said, again, there may be, these things may be true in principle, but how can anyone ever be fully righteous before God? He says in verse 2, "Truly, I know it is so." Oh, I know, I hear what you're saying, Bildad. I hear what you're saying. And though those things might be true in principle, when it comes to God, he kind of moves in a whole different realm, you know. How can a person truly be righteous before God? Now, Job is not at a loss of how a person can be right with God or find salvation. He's not questioning this in the sense that, can anybody fully know? He's just admitting that God is so great and that man is not. And that we can never be fully pure, innocent before God. There's great truth to that. We can never look at our lives and think that we're the reason we're saved, that we just kind of clean ourselves up so well and my right standing is really a product of how I've been living now. That my righteousness is really a product of me just really, you know, applying certain things into my life and just living my best for God. We can never look at ourselves. We have nothing to boast in of ourselves. God is so great that we never have anything to boast in comparison to who he is. We're nothing without him. Our salvation is dependent upon him and the work Jesus did for us. We are in him and in him alone. And we have, like we've been seeing in Romans, we have nothing that we can bring to the table and add to that. So Job goes on to show really just how mighty God is. He goes on to say in those verses that we've read already, especially in starting in verse 5, that he can remove the mountains and he shakes the earth. He can stop the sun. He lays out the stars of heaven. He can walk on the roaring waves of the sea. He created the great constellation of stars, the Bear, the Orion, the Pleiades, and the whole southern hemisphere. I mean, he does things we don't even have the ability or comprehension to fathom. God is so much beyond our thinking and our ability to grasp. He's so much greater. And this is what Job is saying. How can we ever come and answer before him? Nobody's able to question God or have any kind of legitimate challenge for him. And so in verse 14, "How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I cannot answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause." Verse 18, "He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a matter of strength, indeed he is strong. And if it of justice, who will appoint my day in court? Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. So Job is speaking as though he were looking to take God to court now, in a sense, you know. And he wanted to reason with him and ask why this was happening to him. The problem was that in a courtroom, a person could go and examine another person, but then that person would be able to cross-examine that person. And so Job's sitting here going, man, if I open myself up to cross-examination, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble here before God. Job is fearing what that might look like if God were to start questioning him. And so he says, I cannot answer him. It'd be like a crushing blow to me. And so Job knew that even if he claimed that he was righteous or blameless, as he says in verse 20, Job knew that even if he claimed he was righteous or blameless, admitting that would reveal his own pride. It would condemn him. Like even if I spoke and shared that I were blameless or righteous, my own mouth would condemn me, he says there in verse 20. I'd be guilty right then and there because I'd be boasting, I'd be prideful in what I have done. He says, I can't stand before God in and of myself. I don't have a leg to stand on. But then he says in verse 21, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. It is all one thing. Therefore, I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? Job definitely felt like he was blameless. Now again, not speaking about perfect and sinless, but just, you know, morally upright. There's not an accusation that somebody could bring against me, you know. I've been morally upright. But he says it really makes no difference to him because God does what he does. This is what he's saying here in verses 21 to 24. Sometimes the blameless as well as the wicked are removed. Just like we've been seeing in Romans, God will have mercy on whom he has mercy. God is God. It goes beyond our ability to figure out and to understand how God does things, why he does things. He's God, though. And we have to let him be God. And we have to be content and comfortable to be in that place where I don't understand. I don't know how he does these things, what he's doing. But we know that he's at work. Job is admitting these are matters difficult to understand. But remember, here's a man, he's broken, he's suffering, and he's venting and just trying to make sense of it all. And so he's just kind of laying it out there. But he recognizes God is the one behind everything. God is the one that's at work. God is doing these things that don't make sense to us. Sometimes a plague, verse 23, the scourge, say suddenly a plague can come in. And he might laugh at the plight of the innocent. Now we understand that God's not laughing at the plight of the innocent, but Job is just kind of going, sometimes God removes people that don't deserve to be removed. And he says in verse 24, if it is not he, then who else could it be? Who's at work here? God is the one behind everything. And he does things that don't always make sense to us. That we don't understand, that we won't have answers to this side of eternity. But yet, God simply just wants us to trust him and to know that he's working all things out. Verse 25, we'll wrap it up here. Now, my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They pass by like swift ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say, I'll forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile. I'm afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I'm condemned, why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, and that we should go to court together. Nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me. Do not let dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me. So Job was resigned to the fact that he could not be found innocent before God. Even, and he kind of paints a picture. He's saying, even if I were to go and cleanse myself, wash myself with soap, if I were to do all this stuff, well, then God would just pick me up and throw me in a pit. I'd be dirty again. He would find reason to have fault with me in a sense. Job's resolved to this fact now, going, There's nothing I could do to be innocent with God. And in that same breath, he's recognizing this isn't about what I've done. This isn't about my fault, my sin, my innocence or lack of innocence. This is God being God. This is God doing what he desires to do. And he's saying, oh, if only I could just have a mediator to make things right here. Maybe to bring sense to things. Maybe to reconcile these things. If I could just have a mediator. Let him take his rod away from me. But we today are so blessed because we do have a mediator. One that has removed the rod of affliction from us. A mediator that has reconciled us to God. That is Jesus, of course. Turn to Hebrews chapter 9 with me just to end here. Hebrews chapter 9. This is Job's desire. Oh, if there was a mediator between us who may come and reconcile, take this rod away from me, then I would speak and not fear him. Hebrews 9, verse 11. Says, but Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and cows, but with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Job is here praying, oh, if I were to clean myself, I would just be found dirty again. But here in Hebrews, we're seeing that we have been cleansed with something greater. And verse 15 says, for this reason, he is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. We have something so worthwhile in the Lord and through Jesus. Jesus being the mediator that has removed that rod of affliction from us that was sin, that was weighing heavily upon us with a kind of weight that Job was experiencing in a very literal, tangible way. The affliction of God, and yet God has removed that from us through his son, Jesus Christ, who's come to be a mediator to us and for us and bring reconciling relationship with the Father and with his children now. We have a mediator. We have something to rejoice in. Oh, you know what? You may encounter difficulty, hardship, suffering, but the bottom line is we have a mediator that has made everything right. Right with God. Relationship with God. Eternal inheritance. Where we know, just as Bildad even said to Job, the latter end will be better than the beginning. Praise the Lord for that. Well, I want to take some time and just pray. And again, this is an opportunity, I think, for us just to come tonight here alongside those in our church that maybe are going through some real difficulties and hardships.